media manager. Details at democracynow.org. It's full-time in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tamaria Studio, and Libby Rainey. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and John Hamilton. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Also thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gadars, and Karl Marxer. You can go to our website for democracynow.org podcasts, video and audio podcasts, as well as transcripts. Tomorrow, we look at the George H.W. Bush invasion of Panama. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Clinton Street Resistance Series at the Clinton Street Theatre in Portland. Monday, December the 3rd at 7 p.m. will be Dune, playing as a benefit for Impact Northwest. Dune is a 1984 American epic science fiction film written and directed by David Lynch and is the controversial adaptation of Frank Herbert's cult science fiction novel. Again, that's Dune, playing Monday, December the 3rd at Clinton Street Theatre, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide.
This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years.
Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten-Free Gem, Wii Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give
or call 503-231-8032.
Support KBOO,
where music makes the movement.
The time is 5:01 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Latin Waves. Enjoy.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Capitalism does not have any duration. It does not exist outside our activity. If capitalism exists today, it's not because it was created 100 or 200 years ago. If capitalism exists today, it is because people are producing it today.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. We speak to John Holloway, author of Crack Capitalism and Changing the World Without Taking Power. He speaks about the role of the individual in perpetuating a system based on capital and consumption. As John puts it, the question we should be asking ourselves is not how do we defeat capitalism, but why do we keep reproducing it every day?
John Holloway is the author of Crack Capitalism, Change the World Without Taking Power. He's also the author of Zapatista, Rethinking Revolution in Mexico and Global Capital, National State and Politics of Money. Thank you very much for joining us today. Now, in your book, Crack Capitalism, your latest book, you argue that radical change can only come about through creation, the creation and expansion and multiplication of cracks in the capitalist system. Can you give us an example of how an average person creates cracks in this system?
I think we do it all the time, in fact. As a way into talking about that, there was something that really caught my attention in the email that you sent me, where at the bottom of the email, and I suppose at the bottom of all the emails that you that you send, there's a quotation from Arundhati Roy, which says, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." I mean, that seems to me an absolutely beautiful quotation. I didn't know it at all. But it seems to me that that is what I'm trying to do in the book, to listen to the breathing of this other world, this other possible world. And I think that breathing is actually something that is present in all of us and present in our everyday lives. So I think central part of my argument is really that there is nothing special about being anti-capitalist, that we are all anti-capitalist in one way or another. I mean, some of us are very committed and conscious of being anti-capitalist. Others just see it in terms of decency, in terms of love, in terms of the way, the sort of way we want to relate to the people around us. So you can think of this other world that is breathing. You can think of it, say, in terms of the Zapatistas, who were on a very big scale and a very clear project to actually create another world here and now. But you can also think of it in terms of a gardener. I mean, somebody who just cultivates a garden in order to create a different world with a different relationship with the plants. I mean, a relationship with other forms of life that goes against the dreadful destruction of life that capitalism implies. One of the things that I say at the beginning is really that the book is the story of many, many people, of millions, perhaps billions. It is the story of the composer in London who expresses his anger and his dream of a better society through the music he composes. It is the story of the gardener in Cholula who creates a garden to struggle against the destruction of nature, of the car worker in Birmingham who goes in the evenings to his garden allotment so that he has some activity that is meaning and pleasure for him, of the indigenous peasants in Ovantik Japas who create an autonomous space of self-government and defend it every day against the paramilitaries who harass them, of the university professor in Athens who creates a seminar outside the university framework for the promotion of critical thought, of the friends in Porto Alegre who form a choir just because they enjoy singing, of the theatre director in Vienna who decides she will use her skills to open a different world to those who see her plays, of the radio presenter in Vancouver, I could have added, who creates a program in order to open up other types of discussion that go against the logic of capitalism, of the people who just try and create relations with the people around them that don't follow the logic of money, that don't follow the logic of profit. And if you think of anti-capitalism in that way, you begin to see that really all the time we're trying to break with this logic that we know is destroying the world and that we feel all the time as something oppressive and alien. So that these kind of little spaces or little moments I call cracks, because they seem to be cracks in the logic of capitalist development. The processes of negation and creation, processes in which we say, no, we don't want capital, we want to create something else. So it's really going beyond shouting against the capitalists and trying to begin to create the other world that we so desperately need. But we don't do it, seems to me, on a big scale. We do it sometimes on a big scale, but lots of times we do it on a small, very small scale, just with friends, say, creating a community garden. And sometimes they're not necessarily cracks in space, they can be cracks in time. You know, now in the half hour of this interview, or however long we take, you know, our concern is really, how do you bring to life this other world that we can hear breathing? How do we nurture it? How do we create something different? Not how do we make money for the next half hour, but how do we go in a different logic? And I suppose that most of your listeners are really thinking in the same terms. The book is about how you can hear the breathing of the other world through these cracks, through these different moments of negation and creation. But not only that, also to think about the problems that they face, because although it's clear that these cracks are very inspiring and very exciting, it's also very clear that they have very big problems, precisely because they run counter to the logic of capitalist development. So I'm trying to think, on the one hand, kind of sing a song of praise, I suppose, for the cracks, and on the other hand, to think, yeah, we mustn't romanticize them too much, because they are within the context of a capitalist society that is running on a mad chase towards the destruction of humanity altogether. So how do we actually think about that clash between the two logics? And how do we nurture and give strength to the cracks that begin to open a different world?
Invariably, people are kind of associating capitalism with freedom and democracy. And this problem with using the language interchangeably really troubles me, because I don't think that this is the case. I think that the language has been co-opted. And when we talk about freedom, we are talking about choices. We're talking about market choices. And within a choice based society, those with more money have more choices. Those with wealth have power to decide, and the rest of us are not invited to the table to make decisions. So I wonder if you could focus on the myths that sustain capitalism. What are some of those myths, and what prevents us from looking beyond creating something new and imagining, as you point out, using our creativity to imagine something new?
I suppose I think that possibly the strongest myth that sustains capitalism is simply the idea that there isn't any alternative, that we can't, that the idea that we can't change it. And it just seems to me so obvious now that capitalism is an absolute disaster. I mean, it's an absolute disaster, not only because of the way in which it creates great inequalities, but I mean, we all know now, I think, that if we don't break with capitalism, then it is very, very likely that human life will not last for very long. I mean, we know what capitalism and its dynamic is doing to nature, to the natural preconditions of our own existence. We know the sort of violence that it's creating. We know the inequality. We know the stress that we live through at work every day. Okay, I mean, there are kind of myths of freedom and democracy, but we know also that the political system is a farce. We know that elections are not going to change things radically. We know that freedom is limited by money, that it's a farcical freedom. I suppose what I feel is perhaps what we should do is think that really most of us know that capitalism is a disaster. What we don't see is the existence of alternatives, and the existence of alternatives not only are not so much in terms of great revolutions, but the existence of alternatives in the way in which we do things every day. I mean, if we go out for a meal with friends, for example, right? This is in many ways normally an anti-capitalist process. I mean, not in the sense that we're going to steal the food. I mean, maybe we will, but that's not what I was thinking of. Just in the sense that we sort of discuss together democratically, well, what type of food would we like? Where will we go to eat? What time will we meet? And so on. I mean, that kind of push towards self-determination is actually part of a very deep part of our everyday lives, and it is something that runs counter to determination of decisions by money and by profit. My feeling is that really left discourse much of the time concentrates too much on denouncing capitalism. I think that is important. I mean, I think it is important all the time to say what an awful system it is and how unjust, and to point this out in detail. But I think perhaps it's more important at the stage at which we're at the moment, it's more important to say, well, yeah, I mean, capitalism is just an awful system. Capitalism is our suicide. What are we going to do about it? We can no longer think in terms of revolution in 50 years' time. That's silly. What are we going to do about it now? How do we come out of capitalism now? How do we nurture this other society or other world that we can hear breathing, according to the quotation from Arundhati Roy?
One of the key components that you're describing about an alternative is to begin asking the question, if we're not going to be organized in a hierarchical way where we're abiding to some political official or someone who is elected, and by that we dismiss our own responsibility, then I guess what you're proposing is to create something where we're horizontally organized and also equally responsible for the outcomes of whatever we put in place. And the biggest obstacle to seeing a world that's not based on a hierarchy and a structure of dominance of, you know, men over women or of manager over worker, etc., is usually the idea that we can possibly organize ourselves and be able to resolve conflicts if we're all equal. How do we bridge that gap then? Because that's another, I think, obstacle that we face. We've been so accustomed to seeing ourselves in this hierarchy, seeing the person at the top as having this almost unchallenged authority, and we give legitimacy without questioning. Why? Why do we do that? You know, and could we do it differently?
I suppose three answers occur to me. Firstly, the example I gave a moment ago, I mean, just look at our own lives and look at the way we decide things in lots and lots and lots of instances is not hierarchical. We actually have a daily practice of horizontalism. We have a daily practice of trying to find common solutions together. Secondly, I think if you look at the social movements, or the anti-capitalist movements, especially of the last 15, 20 years, before that as well, but it's become an important theme of the last 15, 20 years. If you look at the Zapatista movement in Chiapas, if you look at the uprising in Argentina at the beginning of the decade, if you look at movements all around the world and the way in which they are placing emphasis on developing different sorts of forms of organization precisely to encourage people to participate fully or to articulate their views fully, to reach decisions that we all share, then I think you can learn from that experience, I mean, just how well horizontal decision making can work or does work in the vast majority of cases. And the third point, I think, is simply that we can't go, I mean, it's clear we can't go on the way we're going. Now, if we go on the way we're going, it's really quite likely that we'll destroy the world or destroy human life on the world. In some sense, we have to assume our own responsibility for the future of humanity. You know, we can no longer say, well, it's the responsibility of the leaders, it's the responsibility of the president or the prime minister or the politicians or the leader of the party or the revolutionary leaders. No, when you're kind of faced with catastrophe, then the only possible thing is to take our own responsibility.
What inspires your work?
I suppose what we all see around us is, on the one hand, a system of social cohesion, a kind of coherent system that seems to knit together out wanting to scream. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, I suppose what we also see around us really all the time is struggles against this system. Fantastic struggles lots of times, or just tiny little struggles which are also fantastic as well. I suppose that's what inspires my work. And then, yeah, obviously just thinking about that and reading about that and reading people who are thinking about that.
I was interviewing Bruce Dixon, and he was talking about how if a corporation were truly human, the corporation VP, for instance, the one responsible for the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, would be now about 120 years. And he points out how these organizations are immortal and their actions are often excluded from the responsibilities of other human beings. So as you're talking about what inspires you, as you're talking about the way we are changing, the way we are struggling, the legacy of resistance, I think about the connection, right? The connection of people becoming awakened to this world that has sort of inverted, co-opted our language and used it against us, you know, where we're giving rights to corporations to pollute and kill people openly, where we're giving a mass industry like militarism the right to use our wealth that we'd like to use for health and education to kill others and bring disaster to the lives of millions in other places, you know, people who have, like us, brothers, sisters, mothers. So it's important that we look at this stage, I think, not only as a turning point, but also as a key catalyst for what moves us to act. In your book, you call us to action. What would you ask people to do? What do you hope will come out of people reading your book?
I'm not sure if I call people to action. I think what I want to do really is for us to recognize that we are already acting in lots of ways. You know, that also things that we consider insignificant are very often the creation or the possible creation of a different world. I suppose what I'm trying to do is say, look, the answer really lies with ourselves. It lies with ourselves because the problem is not the corporations. The problem is ourselves. The problem is that on the one hand, we are creating capitalism. And on the other hand, we are also trying to do something else. We are creating capitalism because the fundamental problem is not actually capital. The fundamental problem is the labor that creates capital. If you think of these cracks, if you think of this breadth of the other possible world, or these different areas of breathing of the other possible world, then you can see really that they're distinguished by the attempt to create a different sort of activity, different sorts of relationships, different sort of logic. Okay. On the other hand, we know that we also labor. Most of us have to sell our labor power, our ability to work, to capital in order to produce things that will sell, or in order to promote in some way the conditions of capitalist reproduction. Okay, so we're kind of caught by this bifurcation, if you like, of this antagonism between capitalist labor, the labor of actually producing and reproducing capital on the one hand, and developing an activity that makes sense to us on the other hand. So the way I see the possibility of change, and the way in which I see what's happening at the moment, is in terms of a revolt of doing against labor. I think more and more over the last 15, 20 years, we have come to understand that the struggle against capital is not the struggle of labor against capital. It is, in fact, the struggle against the labor that produces capitalism. In other words, the struggle is to reject the sort of activity that produces the corporations, that produces, of course, the weapons, that produces commodities, and to try and develop an activity that simply that has sense for us, I think. It's an activity that we consider useful or necessary. And I think we're all in that. I mean, you're producing and the host of this program, but you're doing it because this is an activity that has sense to you. I'm a university professor. Okay, in that sense, I sell my labor power and I get paid for it. And I have to go through certain hoops that I hate. But I also try and develop my activity in a way that makes students critical, in a way that I enjoy, in a way in which the focus of teaching and of learning really becomes the question of how we can move on, how we can overcome capital. I assume that all our listeners are caught in this sort of antagonism that actually cuts through us. I mean, we are schizophrenic just by the fact of living in an antagonistic society. We are schizophrenic. So the question of how we strengthen the cracks is the question of how do we strengthen our own doing against labor? How do we actually turn our activity more and more against labor? And that actually takes us into a whole, I mean, part of the argument is that labor brings with it all sorts of things, I mean, historically and logically, that labor, or what Marx calls abstract labor, capital producing labor, brings with it a certain form of sexuality, a certain form of relation to nature, a certain concept of time, a certain certain forms of organization. And that if we try to break that, as we are doing, if we break with that, then what we do is we develop other forms of sexuality, other forms of relation with nature, other concepts of time, other forms of organization. And I think that's what's happening in the anti-capitalist movement at the moment, that there is a kind of a deep shift taking place. And the deep shift is actually has as its axis the rejection of labor and the understanding of anti-capitalism, not as the struggle of labor, but the struggle of a different type of activity. A central point of that is the question of time. Capitalist labor is really tied up very much with the notion of clock time, with the idea that time is something outside us, that time is something that moves forward independent of our activity. And that is what gives us the idea that capitalism exists from one day to another to another. Whereas really the problem is to break that concept of time and to understand that, no, time is not independent of our activity. Capitalism does not have any duration. It does not exist outside our activity. If capitalism exists today, it's not because it was created 100 or 200 years ago. If capitalism exists today, it is because people are producing it today. So that means that the question of revolution, the question of how to break with capitalism, it's not the question of how do we break, how do we abolish something that exists. It is really the question of how do we stop producing capitalism? How do we stop making capitalism? And the only way in which we can stop making capitalism is by creating something else. And I think that, it may sound a very roundabout or complicated way of saying it, but I think that's actually what's happening. I mean, it's really this awareness that it's not the question of building up the great organization. It's not a question of overthrowing the state. That's not revolution. Revolution is actually saying, well, no, we're not going to act in that way. We're not going to labor. We're not going to structure our activity from one day to another in terms of the needs of capital. We are going to do something else. We're going to we're going to stop making capital.
For people listening to this, you know, it seems like an alien idea to consider that we create capital by becoming commodified units ourselves, right? By allowing ourselves to become just another form of commodification, the way we are, we made our life available and act in the workplace without a connection to how that impacts all the other aspects of our lives. The Industrial Revolution had this many ideas that, you know, it will bring us leisure, that with all this technology that people would work less. But you're right. Instead, we are producing more. We're constantly producing more that feeds and maintains the structure of capitalism. How can people access your book?
People in charge of the distribution are Fernwood Books.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us today, John. John Holloway is my guest. He is the author of many books, including, well, his book, Change the World Without Taking Power, Zapatista, Rethinking Revolution in Mexico and Global Capital, National State and the Politics of Money, and his latest book, Crack Capitalism. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed, Sylvia.
Take care.
Thank you.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
All of us can agree on the importance of home in our lives, but what do we mean by home? And once we settle on that home, how do we fit in as part of a larger community? And if there's no community, how do we make one? These are important questions for those who've come to the U.S. from other countries, and even those of us who were born here but may have moved around from place to place. And these are the questions our in-depth guest tonight, Carolina Pfister, asks and tries to answer in her audio project, I See You. Carolina is a multicultural artist and director of the nonprofit organization Culture Seed, who immigrated to the U.S. from her home in Brazil. Carolina describes her work and art as motivated by the belief that to be home is to seek awareness of the life around us, of who came before, and how personal choices, culture, and socio-political structures knit the web of us. We're fortunate to have Carolina live in our KBOO studios to talk about her work and the ICU audio project. The third episode in the series premieres on KBOO tonight at 11 p.m. Carolina Pfister, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Carolina, first, can you tell us a little bit about your experience immigrating to the U.S. from Brazil and why you chose to come to Oregon?
Well, as Latin American immigrants go, I'm not the typical immigrant.
You were originally from Switzerland, right?
Yeah, I was born in Switzerland, and my parents left Brazil during the military dictatorship, and so I was born there and was in Switzerland for the first 6 years of my life. But I consider myself Brazilian because that's where I was shaped, basically. I came to the U.S. for graduate school, not quite sure that I was going to stay, so in that way, it's an atypical immigrant experience. And for a long time, I didn't necessarily call myself an immigrant. I was staying, not sure that I had stayed. But children put a twist in the narrative. And now I understand myself to be an immigrant, and I understand what that experience feels like in terms of being constantly in between. I've been here long enough that I'm not fully Brazilian anymore, and I notice that separateness when I go back home. And I know that I'm never going to be fully from here. So it's an in-between space. And I've noticed other people who have similar experiences echo that sentiment that we live in between.
Now, how does the sense of community in Brazil compare to what you found here in Portland?
Wow. I don't think I can tell you in a neat little package what the differences are. There are cultural differences that feel very real and that feel more so over time, and especially as a mother.
How Brazilian would bring up children as opposed to how an American would bring up children?
Or? Absolutely. And also the fact that I have a very large family in Brazil, and most of the time as a mother in the U.S., it was just our little nuclear family, which is not a sustainable thing, I feel, for the raising of children. And I understand the making of community outside of my family, to be working together, to be actively supporting each other. And this audio project was very much the way in which I chose to make community in Portland. As a mother of young children, it was a way to just be out there with my neighbors. It was an interesting experience.
Actually, that was going to be my transition from community to the audio project, I See You. What was the initial spark of the project? Was it questions you were asking yourself about how you fit in and the differences between raising children in Brazil and family in Brazil versus family in the U.S.? And
all of that. All of it. It's, in many ways, the way I observe day-to-day life, I can't help but always think how the microcosm is a reflection of the bigger structure, and we're a building block, but we also speak to the forces that shape us, you know, from a block level, which was my project. I took out the microphone and recorded my block for a whole year. And then the audio project and what I write and the way that the story is being shaped, it goes from macro to micro. And I feel that when we stop and observe, when we pay attention, a lot of things happen. It not only nurtures a connection that maybe wasn't there before, but curiosity does connect you to place and to your neighbors in a way that if you are living in a neighborhood and not paying attention to those who live around you, you don't have that ownership even. So this project speaks to everything that concerns me and everything I pay attention to, but it was also shaped by then what my neighbors were seeing. In the U.S., I've only lived in gentrifying neighborhoods, and by the time we got to Portland and once again landed in another gentrifying neighborhood, this was also a central question to why I picked up the microphone.
And in Portland, it's not that rare, unfortunately.
No, and I moved here right in the thick of it, you know, 6 years ago, so...
Now, was the initial plan, you mentioned recording your neighbors first for a year. Was that with the plan of doing an audio podcast or kind of not knowing what you're going to do with those recordings? And then how did you get to the point where you came up with this idea of a multi-part series? And I read on the net initially it was 5 episodes, and you told me before the interview it might go 6.
Yeah, I actually had been working around similar themes. I have been working around similar themes forever. And I've been very intrigued by the audio world in the U.S. We don't have strong independent radios in Brazil or an audio tradition. Now it's starting, but definitely not when I left. And I was just blown away by the quality of the podcasting that was happening in the last 10 years here. Or more, 15 years, and had been really inspired to work with that medium. Also, it's very nimble. It's affordable. As a mother, as a working mother, I could fit it in, you know, these crevices of free time. But I did propose the project as a fully thought-out project already, because I wrote a Regional Arts and Council Culture Project Grant and was fortunate enough to receive that first legitimizing kind of, okay, you got the grant. Now you have to go. I'll do it.
And a Caldera artist residency also?
Yeah, which was amazing. So after the full year of recording, I got to go to Caldera, which was my first art residency. And they are also very acceptant of families. And, you know, it just fit very well. And I figured out how to edit this, what the tone would be for the whole thing.
So this next question, I think, is something you probably answered getting the grants and the residency. You have young twins. You said they're 8 years old now. They announced the closing credits of each episode. There's 3 episodes available now. Well, the 3rd episode premieres tonight. And one of them signed off, thank you for listening to my mother's stories. I'm not sure what they're about. So I don't know if this is a fair question, but what would you tell someone that they're about?
Oh, wow. I wish I had a great little rehearsed elevator pitch. I see you.
Your son did a pretty good job, though.
Yeah.
He was, you were asking him questions, what do you think it's about? And he actually mentioned some pretty good things.
Yeah, I think they get that I'm talking about everything. So at one point he said, it's about the world.
That's always a safe answer.
It is with this mama, it is. I'm thinking about it all. Yeah, I mean, it's called I See You, and it's about stopping and listening, and how does all of this connect to the ways in which we are living together. This is a very urban story too, especially in the beginning. I won't tell you why it changes later.
I know why.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I do have one question about that.
Please.
But I hope that's a little later, but
okay.
I hope it doesn't kind of ruin the effect. Well, we're only like two episodes in it right now, with the third one tonight. So
yeah, no, but, we can talk about it.
Okay, now you mentioned these are themes that you've pursued in other artistic works, and you've written essays. There's a book in the works, a children's book. You've made music, you made films, and if we have time, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the film Viva Viva. You mentioned one reason you decided to do an audio piece, a podcast, was because of the flexibility, and it wasn't all that expensive to get started like a film might be. But there must have been a lot of challenges in ramping up and kind of the learning curve involved.
Well, you know, it's funny. I just kind of threw myself at it. I already loved editing. I've edited my own films.
And audio editing is really just an offshoot of video editing.
And
actually, it's twice as easy, right? Because you don't have
the
visuals.
It's actually quite lovely. I used to love editing audio for films.
Uh-huh.
So I was very excited about the opportunity to just edit audio. And I found it to be as magical as I thought it would be. I am completely hooked. I just want to edit audio. The microphone, yeah, I could have, should have, perhaps had a mentor.
What did you use? Was it a digital recorder and the built-in mics, or did you have an external mic connected to it?
I had an external mic, mm-hmm. Yeah. But just around placement, around room tone, around coaching people how to move their bodies around the microphone. You know, later I had some problems, but luckily I've been doing the project mostly by myself, and then Jesse Stevens, an audio artist that I met at Caldera, volunteered his work to master the interviews and then master the piece itself. So we kind of just exchange files online, and he does his magic, and things come back unhissing and with less tapping around it. And
oh, that's amazing.
Yes.
So he just has a little bit more sophisticated audio editing software.
Exactly.
That he uses.
Which is exactly what I don't want to learn. I love editing and I love mixing, but the mastering just, I wasn't too crazy about it.
Now, as mentioned, there's currently three episodes of I See You, with the third episode premiering tonight at 11 on KABU. Let's talk a little bit about each one. The first episode, and they get longer and longer as we go along. The first episode's called Psychic Home, runs about 10 and a half minutes, and that sets up the series. So what were you doing in there? Just kind of a teaser, or putting some context around the remaining episodes?
Yeah, I think for me, Psychic Home is about exactly that. The spaces we call home, be it psychic or physical, and I'm right now in my 33rd home. So home is a very active thing in my life.
And that's
home.
Switzerland, Brazil, and Oregon, and maybe other states in the
U.S.?
Yeah,
in the U.S. I've lived in quite a few places, and in Brazil too, hopped around a little bit. And
so the question of home is a big one on your mind all the time.
It is. And the physicality of it, and especially as a mother, making home now is a very powerful thing, as I create a space that represents a lot for my children and what that means. But Psychic Home was yeah, you could call it a teaser, although I feel it's a complete setup of...
Well, you get into the neighborhood, which I think is important, and you mentioned it's one block. It's in Northeast Portland. And can you describe it? It was previously a mostly black neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then it's getting gentrified, so people who aren't black are moving in, and rents are going up, and housing prices are going up.
Exactly. And that's, you know, exactly the dynamic I landed in once again. Our experience of Northeast Portland was very diverse. We lived on a very diverse block and a very lively block. And something happened on the block that all the parents started coming out because the children were playing with a basketball hoop. And I talk about this in the chapter that's premiering tonight. And as I was observing this, what made us actually get together and actually talk to each other were different depending on who and why. For example, the parents came out because the kids came out. I interacted with one of my African American neighbors after an altercation around noise and learned a lot, as I hope he did too. It was some very honest conversation, some of which I have recorded and is in chapter two. As far as the typical Portland experience, I feel that we're told it's a very white city. That was not my experience of Portland.
Oh, certainly not where you were living. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned there were two black families on the block. You mentioned something that something that seemed ironic, a little funny for me, that there were two Black Lives Matter lawn signs, but they were not on the lawns of the people who own the homes.
They were the middle-aged white women.
So it's a fairly diverse block. I mean, even for Portland, even for a gentrifying neighborhood. And then the person you alluded to as Fred, the neighbor, who I found exceedingly interesting.
Yes.
You mentioned he's mostly covered in the second episode. That's called My Year of Noise. That one runs about 25 minutes. A very descriptive title, because as you said, that's kind of the issue that is the focus of what brought the neighbors together and focus certainly of episode two. Fred, our first impression of, we get to know him a little bit better, of course, as it goes along. Our first impression, mine at least, he's rude, he's noisy, he's evasive. How did you meet him and get him to answer at least a few of your questions? He seemed like he definitely did not want to do that.
He didn't. I don't know. I have no qualms about approaching people.
That was very clear from the series.
I try to, you know.
You're very brave. I was going to say bold, but brave sounds better.
Maybe for North American cultural dynamics, I am. But as a Brazilian, I'm pretty typical. We talk to people, no matter who, and the color lines aren't so stark in Brazil. Fred was just a neighbor that I was having some problems with, who was rude once or twice to me, and I didn't walk away. I went up to him and said, well, we're neighbors. We're going to have to, you know, we're going to be here, so let's work this out. And, you know, Fred is a lively man full of stories of the neighborhood, and I really wanted to sit with him.
Oh, he's extremely interesting, yes. Yeah. I just loved hearing him. But yeah, he's very direct.
Yeah, so. He came around. I mean, you know, we negotiated. And there were some points where I don't like the feeling of taking that sometimes comes with interviewing people for a project.
They're giving you something and you're not really giving them anything back in return.
And that's been problematic for me because I tend to storytell with real stories, with things that are happening right now, and that exchange, I've still not made peace with it, what it means to take someone's story. Yeah. So Fred and I actually worked it out in a very objective way because he just asked me for something, which I was like, fine.
Oh, was that the cigarettes and a bottle of scotch?
Or Absolutely.
It's funny because you initially offered him beer and he said, I don't drink white people beer.
That's right.
Which is funny in Portland.
Yeah. No, he just, yeah. And that was an assumption from his, you know. We were dealing in assumptions.
I was going to talk about that. His assumption was that you're white.
Mm-hmm.
You describe yourself as a light-skinned Brazilian.
Mm-hmm.
And visibly, you don't fit in with most people of color, certainly not with the black people in your neighborhood. Has that been an issue for you, in addition to being kind of, you're not American, or you are American, you're Brazilian, you're Swiss? I think you mentioned it earlier, too, about the question of how you fit in.
Oh, absolutely.
And so what's the challenges involved? You're not really white. You're not visibly a person of color. it's a very interesting position to be in.
Well, first of all, I've had to learn that here. Brazil's no racial paradise, but we don't divide up in the way that the U.S. has divided up. In terms of colonized countries, Brazil's one that makes the most. We have a variety of colors, and I wasn't aware of that until I lived in the U.S., that this to speak of each other with these very clear divisions. So I've had to kind of shake.
Race just seems to be a much bigger issue in the U.S.
And yeah, and please, not that Brazil is a racial paradise, and actually there's been a much more racial consciousness happening in Brazil since I've been gone, and I've been watching it with relief, like finally there's some movement around that. But there is something culturally that happened that we identify as Brazilians. And here it seemed that the immigration story was much more segregated.
Oh, especially now.
Yeah.
And immigrants are denigrated quite a bit.
Absolutely.
Certainly by the current administration.
So I am proud to be Latin American and South American, but Brazilians aren't very counted in terms of the census of immigrants in the U.S. So there's no Brazilian box to check. I don't check a Hispanic box. I can check a Latin American box. And North Americans understand most Latin Americans to not be white. And I will proudly sit in that category because it feels more like me. Hmm. Whatever white is does not feel like me. But the truth is, it's all a construct anyway, right?
The racism is the interesting thing with you, being factual. In the position you're in. You kind of see that where somebody like Fred assumes you're white.
Well, which I understand why he would.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. I'm the lady who bought the house next door, and that's what's happening in his neighborhood. And I probably dress like the white ladies that he's seen around that
neighborhood. And he's not happy what's happening with the neighborhood.
No, but he's funny because I go up to him and say, he asks me, why do you have this microphone? What are you doing? And I tell him a little bit about my story in the U.S., that I've been landing in gentrifying neighborhoods. And I kind of stuttered and said, you know, and I just want to see where I fit in this story. And Fred says to me, well, you fit in where you can get in. You
know? Another one of his great lines.
Yep.
listeners, you've got to start from the beginning here of I See You at episode one and then Fred in episode two. I don't want you to delay seeing episode three tonight. Of course, it will be archived on the KBOO website.
So
we should mention that too. But it's well worth catching up on episode one and two before listening
Thank
to episode
you.
Three. Now, Fred is just one of several neighbors we hear from in episode two. Can you tell us about a few of the others? There were two that stood out for me. One was Alan, an extremely voice of reason, the head of the neighborhood association. And then your millennial next door neighbor, Will, who's a drummer in a local rock band and practice late at night. Huh?
Yeah, Will was a reckoning. I'll start with Will because it's ironic, or, you know, it's karma. I've also played in bands half my life and don't remember in my early 20s if I was as conscientious as I should have been. And so, of course, we moved right next door to a young man with a rock band. But it was interesting because as we talked, because it was the band and it was parties and our house was like, you know, 10 feet away from each other. It was really difficult and we had young children and Will and I really had to work through that, you know, Will and his roommates and our family and what it meant to what level of noise was acceptable. I mean, it's fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating to me in which ways we come together and have a social contract of sorts and how does culture inform that. And that's why I feel that a certain awareness just makes for community. Because
I think that awareness comes through because it's not just your perceptions. Those are very clear in the first two episodes, but it's also you give voice to the people you're talking about, Fred and Will. It'd be difficult for a lot of us who would have a conflict with a neighbor, especially over noise or leaving their car in the street. I think that was with Fred. It was difficult to get around. His car was parked right in the middle of the road. It would be difficult to try to get past that and understand from the other point of view what was going on. And I think that becomes clear. There's two quotes I especially liked. One, I think, belongs to Will. He says he sees neighbors as mysteries that we don't necessarily have to solve. but to get along, we have to find something to talk with them about. That's pretty wise advice.
That was Alan Silver. And
oh, that was Alan. Yeah. Oh, okay. Alan is the voice of reason. He's the neighborhood association head.
Yes, and he's not our neighbor, but I sought some outside of our block voices. So every episode has, potentially every episode will have, a voice from outside the block. Alan Silver, I felt his reflections were...
He's incredible. He should be president.
I agree. You should hear him in chapter 3. I'm exploring about what it means to... What is soul of a place?
And that's the name of the of episode 3.
Yeah.
There was one more quote. This is from, I think, a neighbor on the block, and this is Bob, who's a retired grocery checker at Fred Meyer. He reminded us that our neighbors come from different places, and we need to learn to give them space and also tolerate the differences. You had some cool people in that neighborhood.
Well, I feel there's cool people everywhere if we just stop and talk to each other. On a block level, if we're not relating, it's a dissonance that feels very odd to me, that you can be on your block for 10 years and perhaps not have met the person that lives across the street, which I witnessed. It's a dissonance I'm not familiar with, and I have other dissonances, cultural ones, but not that one.
No, we have about 2 minutes left. I wanted to get where people could see your work and all that, and I don't think we're going to get to the documentary you did, Viva Viva, which is about the punk scene in Brazil. It came out in 2014. But you mentioned Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the concept of the social contract in episode 2. Can you explain just briefly what the social contract is and how that relates to your narrative?
Well, I was looking for examples in the way that I was trying to use social contract, and breaking off a little bit from the Rousseau explanation of it, which is more of in a democratic sense, So what are the agreements that we make in order to have a society that functions in a efficient manner?
As opposed to unlimited individual freedom, which can impinge on the idea of community and neighborhood.
Absolutely, which is why I bring up Brazil, because we're such a young democracy, and corruption is so cultural that I also do appreciate a lot of the civic engagement that does exist in the U.S. and the awareness around it. Having the ability to reflect from this space in between, I get to see what both versions look like. And
Well, we should wrap up. We've got Labor Radio coming in. Carolina, can you just tell us where listeners can find out more about your work and maybe hear episode 1 and 2 before episode 3 tonight?
Well, 1 and 2 are both on KBOO's website on the podcasting section, and on my personal website. Carolina is spelled just like Carolina, but that is not how you pronounce my name. And Pfister is P as in Paul, Pfister. So my personal website also has that. So for now, those are the two websites that host my work.
Well, Carolina, thanks so much for joining us at KBOO. Obrigada.
De nada. Thank you so much for having me, Ken. That was a great conversation.
We've been talking with Carolina Pfister, multicultural artist and director of the nonprofit organization Culture Seed, and writer, producer, and editor of the audio project I See You. You can listen to episode 3 of I See You on KBOO tonight at 11. It will also be archived if you want to catch up on 1 and 2. And you can learn more about Carolina and catch up on 1 and 2 at carolinapfister.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, host of the Gospel and More program, Sundays from 6 to 8 a.m. We are collecting yarn to make wool caps for the homeless community. Drop off yarn and caps at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th, Monday through Fridays, 9 to 5. We are also looking for knitters. For more information, contact KBOO Gospel and More at gmail.com or go to kboo.fm/gospel and more. The yarn and cap drive will end January the 31st.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide.
This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years.
Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, Wii Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give
or call 503-231-8032.
Support KBOO
where music makes the movement.
The time is 6 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Holla! Welcome to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, here on KBOO 90.